I'll tell you something, that my experience with people with extended vocal technique is just that it's a fabulous a source of research, but it for the moment it has hit an impasse, a kind of a stop, because these people dedicate their whole existence to developing the technique. And it would be a very foolish composer, a good composer, who would compose a piece for one of these singers, because it's a very limited thing and it can only be used by those people who specialize in it. The only thing that I could imagine is that some of these things could be taught to people who are really singers, because I doubt that most of the people involved can really sing in the true sense of the word, you see. And they're kind of, I don't want to be offensive because I don't intend this, but they're in a way, they're freaks, they're phenomenal. What they used to call me, but it wasn't true in my case because I can also sing, you see. But the freak element and phenomenal element with them is all.
Thank you. nothing.
Cathing by Joan LaBarbera. Let's pick back up your story. I guess we must have come in fairly late because we actually have your recording as Lightning Comes, and the other one, which has just escaped me.
Reluctant Gypsy, possibly.
Reluctant Gypsy,
as Lightning Comes and Flashes.
And,
yeah.
And so those were the first pieces of yours that we heard that were yours alone.
Ah, so you didn't have the LP Voices the Original Instrument. That
no,
was the first one that I did.
But we never had it ourselves.
Yeah.
So the influence from that was sort of minor, and we heard the later ones, particularly Shadow Song has been one of my favorites over the years.
Yeah,
and
it's a wonderful piece.
It's just a glorious piece.
Those works, the multi-layered compositions, I started doing those, I would say around 1977, I got a commission from Radio Bremen. Hans Otte, who was a composer, was at that time head of the music department, and he had heard my work and brought me over to Bremen to do a piece. And so I had in mind this layered work, and I just had little sketches in a notebook of what I was going to do. And of course, in Germany, when you do a recording, especially in a recording record, a radio station, they give you the Tonmeister and the engineer and the person who handles the tape and, you know, a five-person team, many of them wearing white gloves. And so they wanted to see the music. And I said, well, the music is basically my own notation, and so you'll just have to trust me that I'm doing what I say I'm doing. So I got in there and started to work, and it was clear they had never heard anything like this before, but within minutes they understood they were experiencing something new. And were absolutely wonderful, and I got through it. The piece is called 12 Song, and it is 12 tracks of voice. What I did was to record what I call the kind of foundation or ground tracks first, which were circularly sung, which means inhaled and exhaled, mm-hmm. on a single tone, mm-hmm. for the entire 12 minutes. So you get a single pitch. It fluctuates slightly, and I was interested in that because I then put multiple layers on top of that of the same tone, mm-hmm. and when they fluctuate microtonally, what you get is this kind of beating, this interference between the sound waves, which gives it a very sort of rich topography, mm-hmm. underneath. And then on top of that, I then layered in a number of these different techniques. So I was thinking of this as a sound painting, that I was actually putting sound with my voice onto the tape the way a painter puts layers of paint onto a canvas, and adding more and adding more and perhaps taking away. The taking away had to do with when you get to the final mix. So I recorded more than I needed. And then in the final mix, we would sort of pare it down to just the material that was needed. Also, I learned a great deal from the engineers once I had done my work, which was to put all of the material on the canvas, mm-hmm. or on the tape.
Right.
We then went to the next stage, which was the mix. And I was fascinated that they were thinking of the stereo horizon and where they were going to place these sounds in the stereo horizon.
Right.
So it was really a kind of collaboration.
And that was your first experience with working with it that way?
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Okay.
And it was just fascinating to me because up to that point in time, you know, I had done a lot of solo work. I had worked with other musicians. I had recorded, but basically recorded, you know, live concert stuff, but not a lot of work where I had access to multi-tracking. And also the whole idea of thinking about how you mix and depth of field and all of these things that have become so much a part of my work at this point in time. But at that point, it was all very, very new to me. And I was just fascinated by the richness that they created giving space to the sounds, so that each of the sounds had its own personal environment, if you will,
exactly,
where it lived. And when you listen to that work and some of the other works that I was fortunate enough to do in European radio stations, you'll get the expertise of that information that that team of fantastic recording engineers gave to my work. So, back to your other idea of the idea of the interpreter and the composer, here we have now the composer who is also the interpreter, who then goes someplace else and collaborates with the technicians. A lot of work in Europe that is done by composers who deal with electronics is done leaning very heavily on the expertise of the technicians. And there's really never a question about whose authorship it is.
In pop music, that sort of team approach is very strong.
Yes,
and you have the long list of credits on the recording, but it's still attributed, well, in pop music, largely to the performer rather than the composer. But
well, and also possibly the producer.
And possibly the producer, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's been this long sort of tradition of assigning authorship to one composer in the non-pop world.
Yeah.
And so this team approach is still in some ways a rarity, because when you're working in a live concert, acoustic concert,
you are very much dependent on your sound reinforcement engineer and staff. They can make or break a concert, whether it's pop music or whether it's classical music. It's very, very dependent on the people running those controls. Once you get beyond a house that you can work in acoustically.
So you took that away as part of your repertoire.
Yeah, I took that away. I took that information, and I became fascinated by this whole idea of layering sounds and creating an orchestra of voices in a way. And after that, I did a number of works that used multi-track compositions and also used electronics. I went out to CalArts in Valencia and got to work on the equipment out there using the Buchla synthesizer. And so I used the Buchla not just to process the voice, but also to locate sounds in space, and did several quadraphonic pieces where I was using the Buchla to create these not only sound paintings but sound dances. Where I was thinking of the sounds as almost solid objects that were moving around the space. There's a work of mine called Autumn Signal that was inspired by the work of Merce Cunningham, where Merce always thinks of wherever the dancer is facing is forward. So it doesn't matter whether the dancer is facing upstage. Mm-hmm. If that's where the dancer is facing, then that's forward. And so this whole idea of working in three-dimensional space instead of two-dimensional space was something that I took from Cunningham. Also in that piece, I was influenced by the work of the writer Emmett Williams and a work of his called Sweethearts, where he takes the word sweethearts and just transmutes it into various different combinations and variations on that word.
I may have even seen that written out. Was it not published in the Cage Notations book, wasn't it?
It may have been. I don't actually remember where I saw it. It was many years ago. But I created my own text, but I was a little bit hesitant to let the text be absolutely understandable or comprehensible. So I used the Buchla to modify it so that it sort of drops parts of words out and modifies them, and also to move them around in space. So, it's that.
Have you re-released that in on say DVD and surround version?
Not in surround. Uh-huh. No, not yet. It's available just in stereo at this point. But at some point now.
Yeah, you're thinking about it.
Yeah, then. Yeah. Because there are a number of works that I did originally, thinking about quad and you know going to surround sound is a very logical next step. So.
Can other performers perform your music, or does it seem to be unique to your own, or have you written music that's more accessible to other performers?
I have. I've written works that I felt specifically could be done by other singers. I wrote a number of works for voice and chamber ensemble. One of them was called The Solar Wind, which uses voice and 10 instruments. I did several versions of that. I then did a version for a choral ensemble with 4 instruments and then for orchestra. But I always thought of that work as one that someone else could do. There was also a work called Vlissingen Harbor, again for voice and chamber ensemble, that I thought another singer could do. To the best of my knowledge, no one ever has. Uh-huh. I wish they would, because I think it would be very interesting. I then was approached by a vocal ensemble, I Cantori. It's a group in Los Angeles. And they had heard my work, Time Trials and Unscheduled Events, which was a work that was commissioned for the for radio broadcast during the Los Angeles Olympics Arts Festival. And so it was, in my mind, a sonic animation, where I was singing the sounds that I thought athletes would make when they were doing their thing. Or I was singing the shapes of...
Did you train in order to discover those sounds?
No. Imagined. I thought about the long-distance runners, uh-huh. and I thought about the breathing, you know, the pacer runner, and then different runners that would come along who had their own rates of breathing. And so I then created all of these and layered them up, and then... Also, going back to the sound painting idea, I sang the shape of divers, you know, as they would leave the diving board and do these beautiful things and then enter the water, uh-huh. and then the sound of the water and the sound of the crowd, all this stuff. So I did this all with my own voice and did a tape piece. It was broadcast, and I Cantori contacted me, and they said, can we see the score? We'd love to do this piece. And I said, well, there is no score. I just wrote it out for myself. And they said, well, could you make a score? So I did. I made a score. I sort of reconstructed it then from the tape and created a kind of map. It's not a score in a traditional way, but it gives basically all of the information and suggestion as to how and when the various layers should be added on. And so they interpreted it. And it's very interesting to compare their interpretation of it to my original. Since that time, I've now let solo singers work with my tape so that I know that the whole piece is there. And they're, again, adding on another layer. So it's as if another...
So they have all the parts.
They have all the parts.
And add one more to it.
They're adding one more to it, which is what I do.
Minus one
drum. No. No, actually, it's what I did, actually, after I had created a lot of these tape works for radio, I thought, well, they've got to have a life after radio. Excuse me. And so I added on another layer live on top of these multi-track pieces. And so when I thought about a solo singer, I thought, well, if I let somebody try one of these works, at least I know the whole piece is there and what they're going to add, as long as they stay within my instructions, is not going to destroy anything. It's just going to add their own personal take on it. So I would give them the same score that I sent to I Cantori, which is for multiple voices, basically lining up all of the material and laying it out for them. And then I let them go at their rate of speed, making choices as they go through the work. Mm-hmm. So long explanation of, yes, I do write for other people. I also wrote a piece recently, actually in not so recent, but 1990 or 91, that I did in 3 versions. One was for voice and multi-track tape, and another was for multiple voices and then for full chorus. And that was called To Hear the Wind Roar. Mm. And I did the solo version of it, E. Cantore did the multi-voice version, and Greg Smith Singers. Did the large-scale version.
And that's not available to you, unfortunately.
It's not. I have a recording of the solo version. I do have some live recordings of both Greg Smith and E. Cantore doing it.
So there's at least a document.
There's a document of it, yeah. And, you know, maybe at some point we'll get to the point where we can dress up those live recordings and see if we can release them.
Do you think, sort of sidetrack on that, do you think that there's a fragility in the life of some of your work because it's not always represented in a sort of reproducible format like a score?
Well, that's why I do so much recording. And I am doing more score making as the years go on. I don't know that anyone would really be interested in reproducing those multi-track pieces. If they were, I think somebody would be able to go to the recordings and work it out. If somebody were really interested, and while I'm still around, I could probably do it.
There's still sometimes the notion that there's a little gilt edge to the score that's not the same as handing a recording to someone or doing a live improvisation. There is a sort of psychology about that.
Well, also that's always the difficulty in making a score. Morty Feldman used to say that music was most perfect when it was in his head, and that then he had to put it on paper, and then the musicians came along, and they were never as good as what he had in his head. So, I mean, he imagined sounds just sort of melting into audibility, that they would become present almost like breathing, mm-hmm. You didn't actually know where they began, and then they were there, and then they would go away, and this very sort of malleable thinking of sound as air, almost, just gorgeous way of thinking.
Do you, the composer, and you, the performer, ever have arguments about your work?
Do me the... The only difficulty I have is when I give it to somebody else, when I actually write down something on paper and then I give it to somebody else, and again, it's never quite what one had in mind, and so you go back
and
you say...
But you can express what you have in mind yourself when you're doing your own.
When I'm doing my own, yes.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah. But I think one of the things that composers struggle with is this whole idea of the shape of the sound, the envelope, if you will, of the sound, the attack and what happens to it when you breathe life into it and how it decays. I mean, all of that is what makes a great interpreter. And
it's not something that dot music, as you can call it,
does
not have enough ways of indicating that.
No, it doesn't. I mean, crescendo and diminuendo and all the various pianos and pianissimos and everything never really come. I mean, you can put 150 marks on a note, but it still doesn't give all the information. The only person who can give all the information is if the composer is the performer. Otherwise, you're always doing a translation. And if the composer's alive, you have the opportunity of discussing how well you've achieved that translation, and maybe you can go back and modify it, if, granted, you get a second performance of a work. But if you're dealing with music by someone who's not around, it's all interpretation. And then you get the musicologists telling you whether it's right or wrong.
We won't talk about the musicologists. We don't have academic qualifications here.
Oh,
on
well.
Our guest today, just to remind our listeners, is Joan LaBarbera. And what have you been doing recently? Oh, wait, one other thing before we get to that. How did your work with Larry Austin come about?
Larry contacted me, and he said he was doing portraits of various people. And he wanted to come and interview me and do a portrait. So he came to Santa Fe, and we did a very long interview, and then he extracted portions of it, and then used various portions of that. And also, we did some recordings of my vocal material, and he then layered that up and created a piece, and then afterwards came back with a score that illustrated, it's very much like the kind of scoring I do. It sort of illustrates what's on the tape and gives a suggestion of what kind of material you can add on top of that as a layer.
Was the creative process in creating that interactive with Larry, or did he just take away each of these things to work with?
A lot of the things that we worked on were in a way of vocal description. We would talk about certain concepts and ideas that I had, and then I would give an example and sing some material. And then he would go and sort of extrapolate from that material and sort of go on with it. Like the idea of mix the paint is something that comes up when we were talking about sound painting, and various concepts. And then he would take the words and sort of put them into this blender and mix them up and then use some of the vocal material and start decorating around it. So that's how that piece came to be.
Fun. It's a fun piece. I enjoyed it very much. I think we might have an opportunity to play it, maybe not now, but maybe soon.
Okay.
But before we have an opportunity to do any of that, Joan? Joan?
Not me.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Hi.
You're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music, your one stop for non-pop. This is Joan LaBarbera on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR, Plainfield. What can you say after that?
You don't. You can't. Just let it go.
I guess you do. We have to thank a few people.
Thanks,
of
people.
Of course. Thanks, people. Of course, to our listeners, as ever, yes, and to those who have helped.
Enthusiastically have called in.
Yes, they always do that. They want to speak to our composers who are here in the studio, even when they're not. And, of course, to the American Music Center and Frank Oteri, who all together helped us with these many interviews we had in New York City, and of course the Argosy Foundation that made possible the fine cuisine.
Yes.
And travel for these interviews. We're going to jump right back into this in order to squeeze this in today. A little excerpt from the Larry Austin part of his three-part piece called Larry Austin, LaBarbera, The Name, The Sounds, The Music, a 1991 piece. It's a little piece, a little excerpt from part two, The Sounds.
Even the Joan is still, it's a single kind of a sound. Oh, it has that oh, and the ah, it just seems to lift up away from it. So I like the idea of going from an oh, ah, it just has a different kind of flow to it.
You like non-pretty sounds. They're modeled on electronic sounds.
What are you doing recently? And maybe if we can blend that in with the question of has moving from the kind of wide horizons of the Southwest here back to New York changed the way you work?
Complicated question. Well, let me talk about a couple of things.
Okay.
One thing is the collaboration with Kenneth Goldsmith, which was a really major work for both of us. When I was invited by the person who was putting this piece together to collaborate with Kenneth, I didn't know his work. And so I went and I saw some of the drawings. They're multiple text drawings. So you have a light and a dark text superimposed, graphite on paper. And Kenny had finished about 10 of the works by the time I saw them. And we talked about my work, what he had heard of my work was my work with Cage and Feldman. And I said, well, you haven't really heard my work. You've heard me interpreting other people. So he went out and I said, I'm not going to give you things. I want you to find out how difficult it is to obtain this music. So I gave him a list of things. And he went out, he found things in used record stores. He found all sorts of things. And came back to me a couple weeks later, and he said, it's wonderful, I love it. So he said, we've got to work together. And he went on, and then he completed the work, 73 poems, which technically is 79 poems. He sort of couldn't stop. but what I noticed when he finally gave me the work was that after he picked up my work, his work changed. So when you see the work, you'll see it's sort of fairly text intensive for the first maybe third of the piece, and then it starts to be more about shapes and various configurations, reclining pyramids and walls of numbers and letters, and then the letters sort of start flying around on the page, and it gets very spacious and airy. Once he gave me the entire piece, I had a huge studio in Santa Fe, which sort of gets to the end of your question, a converted two-car garage. And I put the work up all over the walls. And I just lived with it for a couple of weeks without doing any music, just looking at the different pieces. And when I started working, I didn't start with number one. I started with one that I could deal with and sort of worked in two directions at once. And when I'd reach a point where I couldn't work anymore, then I would go to another section. When I was through with the composing aspect of it, then I went into the studio with Michael Honig, who did the recording and also co-produced with me. So we recorded everything individually. And then it was all layered up in the computer so that we could reconstruct orally what had happened visually. So you get the material overlaid and superimposed. And in the poems, the dark text of one poem becomes the light text of the subsequent poem. So I didn't use the same material, but I used very similar material and would either treat it differently electronically or in a way architecturally. So that
so much part of what you're doing with it and what he's doing with it. And and how about the screens in which you overlay it on the...
Never been published. That's an interesting idea. I have had the opportunity to perform it in a gallery with all of the original drawings in the gallery. And that's fabulous because the audience during the 45 minutes of the performance can look around if they choose and relate to either the drawing that I'm working with or, just the experience of this enormous work there.
Without the visuals here on Calvus and Damien, let's hear some of these. This is on Lovely Music. This is Joan LaBarbera and the poems of Kenneth Goldsmith. This is called 73 Poems, and we'll hear some of these. We'll be right back.
Broadly, lovely, lewdly, mother, nudely,
mother,
rudely,
another,
me, shrewdly,
cover,
crudely,
dourly,
lewdly,
hourly,
nudely,
John Gotti,
rudely,
sourly,
screwed,
half, hourly.
Cologne.
Dourly.
Cologne.
Hourly.
Cologne.
John Gotti.
Stolen.
Sourly.
Swollen.
Half.
Semi.
Hourly.
Colon.
Bruce.
Bruce.
Daddy.
Bruce. Daddy. Daddy.
Drolly.
Daddy. Daddy. Holy.
Holy.
Palpitate. Penetrate. Pearly gate. Water gate. Welfare state. True.
Great.
Great.
The
going
eight.
Straight.
Half past eight. Out of date. Police
wait.
State.
Palpitate.
Cross-pollinate.
Pearly gate.
Hallucinate.
Welfare state.
W.B. Yeats. Clean.
True.
Nose.
Hate.
Fire.
The
hose.
Eight.
Half no bows,
eight, out of
plain
date.
Clothes.
State,
you don't need a weatherman to know which
W-B-8.
Way the wind blows.
Verse 10 of the 73 poems, actually 79 of them, set Kenneth Goldsmith's poem set by Joan LaBarbera. And sung by Joan LaBarbera and conceptualized past the graphics. By Joan LaBarbera.
All done, yes. Well done, too.
We'll have more of them at the end of the show. Let's just go back to the interview and tell you now, because we're going to slide right into these poems at the end of the K&D show today, that next week's guest, for the bubblegum fans among you, and we mean the gum, not the music, is Andrew Violette, who we had a wonderful time interviewing, a very strange character in a lot of ways, but probably most noted on Calvis and Damien by his popping of bubblegum bubbles the entire time that we spoke with him.
Ah, well, a youth twas.
Not our youth.
Not ours,
ah,
no.
Well,
no,
okay.
Reflected in him.
Back to our interview with Joan LaBarbera, and we'll see you next week. From the 73 poems of Kenneth Goldsmith and Joan LaBarbera on Lovely Music. And now back to that question of how has coming back here to New York?
Well, one of the reasons that I came back to New York was that I wanted to be more accessible to both the audience in New York and to the composers that I enjoy listening to and working with. And I was just feeling as if the remoteness of Santa Fe was, I had enough remoteness, and I wanted to come back to
and
the
you
big city.
You weren't headlining the Santa Fe Opera, though.
No. no, I did, every once in a while, I did perform in New Mexico, sometimes in Santa Fe, sometimes in Albuquerque. But there were not a lot of opportunities, so I was always on the road. Mm-hmm. It was nice to be able to get back there. I had a lot more space, obviously, than what I've got here in New York. But just the energy of people is something I really needed. I need this intensity.
Mm-hmm. And New York was the place rather than one of the other cities in the country or the world?
New York, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia. I lived in New York for about 10 or 12 years.
How could you have grown up in Philadelphia and say it with all those syllables?
I worked very hard not to get that Philadelphia accent.
Philadelphia, right? Philadelphia, you know better. You were born across the way.
We won't
Philadelphia.
Go
okay.
I do have one thing that I say, Merry Christmas.
Murray, yeah.
So Murray is one of those things, Murray and Burry and Vurry. One of the few remaining Philadelphiaisms, I think. Anyway, I spent a long time in New York during the early development part of my career, not only working with contemporary music, if we want to call it that, composers and in that area, but also working a little bit in the jazz field. And so I really feel in a way as if my roots, the roots of my career, the roots of my development are here. A lot of the work I do is either here or generated from here. So there's a whole connection between Europe and New York that continues to this day. I mean, the Europeans are actually going out to the West Coast now to see what's going out there, but that's more or less a recent happening. It used to be that they would basically come to New York for their ideas, and New York was, and I think still is, the marketplace where people present their work. So I wanted to get back to that energy. I've also been working here. I have been directing a series for Carnegie Hall called When Morty Met John, which is the work of Cage and Feldman. I've been working with several ensembles here in town, Locrian Chamber Players, and also a new group that we've just launched called Next Works. And so I feel energized back here. That's why I'm here.
Uh-huh. And so speaking of Next Works,
yes.
Where are you going from here?
I'm working on a couple of things. One is a new opera. And a couple of weeks ago, we did an in-progress version of a scene from this potential opera. And the opera is, if I could describe it, it's about the mind of Virginia Woolf. I'm not going to use any particular text of hers, but I've been fascinated for many years about her way of writing, particularly in the stories, where she'll give sort of a kernel of the idea, or you know, if you cook, you know that you make a roux, which is the essence of something, and then you put it away in the refrigerator, and when you're ready to actually do the cooking, you bring it out and you add stuff to it. Well, she did this with her stories. She would sort of put the essence of the work in a couple of pages, and then stick it away in a drawer, and then when somebody wanted a whole story or a novel or whatever, she'd pull out these little ideas and then she'd expand on them and make something into them. What I'm interested in are those ideas because it was, to me, when she was her freest, she really let her mind kind of wander. There's a wonderful short piece called The Black Spot on the Wall where she's sitting, I guess, in a chair and ruminating about what this spot on the wall could possibly be, and takes it in fantastic directions, and at a certain point says, I could just get up and go over and look at it and see what it is, but then that would, you know, take all the fun out of it. It would actually identify what it was. At that point, her husband comes into the room and makes some comment and says he's going out to do something, and he says, oh, how tiresome to have a snail on the wall. And she said, oh, it was a snail. And so, yes, yeah, so all of this sort of squashed into the reality of the situation at that point. So what I'm fascinated by is this idea of taking beautiful germs of thought and these exquisite essences, and trying to explore what her mind might have done with those.
And but you're not going to have any Nicole Kidman style latex.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, although I do say in the score that all of the musicians are Virginia Woolf.
Oh, well, there it is. Everybody
and
gets to wear one.
No, they don't all get to wear the nose. And they are all figments of her imagination. So they're both. They are her and they are of her. And gender is not an issue. So whether they're male or female, they are all Virginia Woolf. Yeah. Because gender was very much an issue in a lot of her writings. This whole twisting and turning of is he, she, or what?
So how did the workshopping of this go so far?
It went beautifully. Yeah. We actually did a performance at the Chelsea Art Museum with this new ensemble, Next Works. And hopefully I'll be able to develop it more and maybe get some funding and go someplace with it. So that's the most sort of exciting idea that I'm working with at the moment.
What is it about opera?
Boy, you know, it's really fascinating. There are so many people. I've been doing a series at the American Music Center called Insights, where I interview composers. And for the first season, I chose to focus on opera because it is so hot at this point in time. And there's so many people doing it. And I chose four different composers. And at each of the sessions, we talked to the participants in the sessions just to find out who they were. Well, they were all composers or performers or people interested in opera, and they had all either just written an opera or were about to write an opera. Everybody's doing it. It's just all of a sudden the whole intimidation of the trappings of opera of the past seem no longer to carry the kind of weight. And everybody says, wow, it's something where you involve theater and visuals and live performance and really anything you want to put in it, whether you want to add electronics, whether you, you know, have one person or 500 people. It's this kind of open area. It has an element of spectacle, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have to be spectacular. Mm-hmm. It's going from music and it's expanding on the idea of music beyond what we had referred to as music theater, and more than theater with music. Opera is really something different.
It's encouraging to hear you say this because we talked to another composer who was so negative about the prospects of another opera being, well, he thought that opera was dead. He thought that orchestras were dead. He wants to write a long opera, but he says that he'll have to fund it himself. He sees no hope that it would ever be performed. And it's just refreshing to hear.
Well, it depends on whether you hang yourself up on it's got to be a formal opera with a full orchestra and 100 people, or if you can be creative and say, well, I want to do an opera. Now, how can I manage to get it done? What are the forces that I think I can pull together to make it happen and do it that way, rather than to put up this wall in front of yourself and say, oh, I'll never get that done. Say, well, I've got this idea. How can I do it so that it will be doable? Mm-hmm. And so people can experience it. And more than theater with music, opera is really something different.
It's encouraging to hear you say this because we talked to another composer who was so negative about the prospects of another opera being, well, he thought that opera was dead. He thought that orchestras were dead. He wants to write a long opera, but he says that he'll have to fund it himself. He sees no hope that it would ever be performed, and it's just refreshing.
I'm repeating myself.
That's well,
just
it, you know, it depends on whether
some way.
You
let's see what happens.
Hang yourself up on it's got to be a formal opera with a full orchestra and 100 people, or if you can be creative and say, well, I want to do an opera. Now, how can I manage to get it done? What are the forces that
see,
I feel
ask this question
I can
again.
Pull together to make it happen and do it that way, rather than to put up this wall in front of yourself and say, oh, I'll never get that done. Say, well, I've got this idea. How can I do it so that it will be doable? And so people can experience it and enjoy it, hopefully, and we can go on from there. And maybe, you know, if the first realization is for 6 or 7 instruments and 2 or 3 voices, if it's successful and you want it to be bigger than that, maybe you can go on from there.
We have one question we've been asking everyone, and you, I think, have partly answered it just with the things that you just said about opera, but it is that the world is really awash in new music of all kinds.
Mm.
Why is more of it being done? Why is more of it needed, for that matter?
Do you mean why does one create music?
Not why does one create, but why does one at least take it out of the drawer and try to have other people play it and hear it?
Ah, because one learns a great deal when you perform. It's one thing to have it in your mind. And I guess, in a way, I would disagree with Morty Feldman. I don't think it's perfect in my mind. I think it. I learn so much when I perform my own work or somebody else's work, because I'm alive. I'm always reacting to the circumstances of the acoustics of the room, to the energy that I get from the audience, to the energy that I get from the musicians that I'm working with, or if I'm working alone, the sound as it comes back to me in that space. I'm fascinated by live performance. John Cage was fascinated by live performance because it's always new, it's always changing. Even if you fix every element, or you think you can fix every element, it's still going to be a unique experience. Every live performance is unlike every other live performance of the same piece.
And the audiences, what about them?
Well, why do they come?
Yeah, why do they come?
I think for the same reason. They want to experience something live. It's not enough. I mean, if you do not have the possibility of hearing something live, the recording is the next best thing. But just for the exhilaration, for the high that you get from performing, and sometimes from just sitting in the audience, you know, when you hear something beautifully played, or sometimes you hear a sound or a combination of sounds that you just never thought of. It's just like, wow, what an idea. That's so great. And to hear that live is like nothing else in the world.
From one of the great creators of sounds we never thought we'd ever imagine, Shona LaBarbara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Dodge had a good time, too.
Yeah. Okay, off we go. Andrew Violette next week. Here are a couple more of those 73 songs, artwork, poems by Kenneth Goldsmith, and created sound and scoring and singing by Joan LaBarbara.
Be whatever will be, free to be, you and me, it seems to be to me. The way it used
as
to be,
as passionate as possible,
to be or not to be. What distressed what?
Whatever will be.
What is what's not?
To be you as
spot that gets me hot.
It seems to be to
did
be.
Not hurt, Mr. Not. Said Mr. Not to what?
To be or not.
Said what to Mr. Not? I'm so hot to trot. It's not a whole lot. Said what I forgot. Quickly tie the knot. Sickened by the rot. To thicken up the plot, a chicken in every pot. Get thee to a nunnery.
So hot to try.
Misery loves company.
It's not a whole lot.
flout 'em and scout 'em and scout 'em and flout 'em.
Quickly,
thought is free.
Sickened by the rock.
I have nothing to say, and I am saying it. And that is poetry.
Leaves of grass.
Get thee to a nunnery.
Ass, grass,
or gas.
Misery loves company.
Hot flash, white flat trash.
And scout 'em and scout 'em and flout 'em.
Stuck fast. A blast from the past. Kiss my ass, Ogden Nash.
I have nothing to say, and I
more mass I love, alas.
And that is
jumping jack flash. Okay. Is gas, gas, gas.
Good.